This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Researchers studying wildlife cannot always get animals to do what they want. So increasingly, biologists are using robots or dummies to try and recreate and completely control animal behaviors. At UW La Crosse, Assistant Professor of Biology Barrett Klein helped create a robotic frog to study the mating habits of a tiny frog found primarily in Central America. He's here today to talk about the project that has been underway for a few years now. I'm wondering if you can first explain who the little Tungera frog is. I understand we're not going to find them anywhere here in this area.
Yeah, certainly. So these are Central South American frogs. The Tungera frog, onomatopoeic term, really would sound something like this in the wild, Tungera. And what you have are these male frogs that will call female frogs in typically ephemeral pools of water. So in theory, you could walk around during a rainstorm in muddy boots and create a little puddle. And male frogs would gravitate toward these ephemeral pools in order to avoid, presumably, predators. So you won't have fish in these ephemeral pools that would eat up their tadpoles. Rather, they can relatively safely call potential mates, females. And these females would hop out of the woodwork toward the ponds if they hear a frog call that is attractive to them. And so it may start out with a simple call, just a whine. Sounds something like, meow. And you might have another frog that would go, meow, meow, meow. And it might be a while before suddenly you'll hear a call that sounds something like, meow, or meow. And this is a more complex call. So the simple call, the whine, plus what's called a chuck or a few chucks afterwards, renders that simple call more complex. Now, the females are almost invariably attracted to the complex calls over the simple calls. But the big question for a while was, why not always start off with a complex call? Because you'll get the female. And more recent research has strongly suggested that the complex call with the chucks can attract predators and parasites in the form of a trachopsorosis fringe-lipped bat, which hones in on a male calling with a complex call, or these mosquito relatives, a family of fly, that can bring parasites and vector those parasites to an unsuspecting male.
Beyond these mating calls, the sounds that they make, there's a physical element to their mating call as well.
Absolutely. So if you watch one of these male mottled brownish frogs in the wild, what you see is the whole body cavity and the whole vocal sac that distends around the mouth area alternating in inflation. So inflation, deflation, and it alternates between the body and the vocal sac. So there's a lot more going on than potentially just the acoustic element of the call. In courtship, there could be visible or visual components, and there could be tactile components, touch components. So say, for example, if you're calling in water, as they do, the displacement of water by a vocal sac that distends could create a series of ripples. Does the female respond to those ripples? Also, you've got this high contrast vocal sac distending, a ridiculously large balloon in front of their face. Is there a visual component? And that's some of the things that Ryan Taylor in Salisbury University and Michael Ryan at University of Texas, Austin, were really interested in exploring, what's called multimodal signaling. What are our perceptual modalities? Well, we've got sight, we've got sound, we've got touch, we've got taste, we've got smell. So we can play around with at least one, and much more complicated, two, and potentially in the near future, three or more of these modalities simultaneously.
And the two of them have been studying the mating habits for the last few years, and they enlisted your help and another designer to help them study the mating habits of these Tungara frogs.
Now, Michael Ryan at UT Austin has been looking at the Tungara frog. He is the Tungara maestro for decades. Ryan Taylor joined his lab as a postdoc at UT Austin, and during that brief window of time that year, I got to meet Ryan, and I heard him give a talk, an excellent lecture, in which he was describing the use of an artificial, what I like to call a faux frog or a robo frog, squirrel frog. And this was his earlier research, and he had what he calls sort of a clunky plaster frog with a hand-pumped condom as vocal sac. And during his talk, he made it very clear that he would love to have a better version of this and potentially an automated version of this. So after his presentation, I approached him and said, I've made fake frogs before, and I've got a friend in New York City, Joey Stein, who works at Moe Inc. in Brooklyn, who his whole business is making interactive, educational, and entertaining displays for natural history museums and other museums. And so I told him that Joey could give him some advice and I could certainly help him out. And he said, you're hired.
I was going to say, you probably were the only person in that room who has previously made fake frogs.
Probably. Yeah. Probably. Yeah, I used to work at the American Museum of Natural History in exhibitions, and we worked on a Hall of Biodiversity. And before that, I worked at Chase Studio Incorporated in Missouri, a natural history display making studio in the woods.
I mean, going back, why was it that you were creating fake frogs? And I've seen, I mean, it seems like not only do you have a scientific background, but an artistic background. You've not only made model frogs, but some model insects as well.
Mm. Yeah, there are many reasons to make doppelgangers and dummies and fakes, faux animals. One is for educational purposes. One is for artistic purposes, and there are wondrous renditions of organisms, either animatronic or static, in both education and in art. There's a third realm of science where it can come in very handy, because believe it or not, a frog either in the wild or in a lab environment doesn't always behave as you might hope. And if you can control aspects of that behavior, if you can make it repeatable, standardized, predictable, then you can lay out an experiment where you can test under different treatment conditions how a female frog can respond to a fake male frog. And as long as that fake male frog is hitting on points that are biologically relevant, then you can say something potentially you can extrapolate to the field, to a natural state. So I brought what I love to do in art and education and natural history display making to science in a couple of forms, and this was one. This was one of my agendas for joining Ryan Taylor and Michael Ryan, working with Joey Stein to make something at least somewhat realistic to play with aesthetics and the role of aesthetics in biology.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Barrett Klein. He's a UW La Crosse assistant professor of biology who's helped design a robotic frog to help study mating habits. The robo-frog is what you've called it. You've actually brought a few with. Can you talk about what exactly it looks like and how exactly it works?
Sure. So I do what I consider the easy half of the job. Joey Stein at Moe Inc. does the electronic animatronic portion. What I do is I take what lessons I've learned in sculpting, in mold making, and casting, and I put together what I try to render as a realistic a frog as I can. And that takes a few steps, at least the way I've done it. There are other ways that are simpler, where you can make a crude frog that can work, and in some situations has worked relatively well, depending on what questions you're addressing.
By crude, do you mean it may not look exactly like the frog?
Correct. Okay. And there are examples of frogs that are made out of wax or clay. And as long as they resemble sufficiently the frog to, say, a predator, you might be able to, as some scientists have done, examine the damage to that fake frog in the field and capture on cameras what potential predators are cueing into colors or behaviors. What I wanted to do was what I deemed a little bit more delicate or intricate, and that was conspecific communication, or communicating to a member of your species, namely a female, when you're a male calling to that female. So in order to do that, what I did initially was I took a herpetology museum specimen, a dead frog, and I made a rubber silicone mold of that frog.
And you brought it with you here.
Yeah, yeah. So these are pretty emaciated urethane casts that were pulled from the silicone mold. This I use only as an armature. And that is, if I've got the relative proportions down of the real organism, then I can sculpt around it. And that's where the sculpture work comes into play. And I'll make, say, a mix of urethane, sculpt epoxy, metal wire, Elmer's glue, a mixed media piece that looks like a body inflated tundra frog.
And it's
without
incredible.
The feet.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And so the next step is to take this sculpted body, this prototype of the frog, and make a two-part rubber silicone mold of that. And that means placing it in a bed of clay, pouring silicone over that. Once that cures, I can peel that off and then place another layer of silicone over the top and then eventually pull out that prototype. So I have two halves to this silicone rubber mold of the body. Now, for the feet, I took feet and did a one-part mold of that so that I could cast it in a very different material, namely hot melt glue. So I've got these rubbery feet that can survive a lot of wear and tear. So the end product is a pretty durable little frog with flexible feet. Next step, drill a hole through the body from the anal region to the oral region. And once I've drilled out that cavity, I'll have a way for something to travel through that will ultimately serve as the vocal sac. Now, this is a... I tried a few things. I tried condoms. They pop. I tried gray party balloons. Work pretty well. In fact, here's one tied with dental floss at the end. But ultimately, Joey and I found that a catheter... and the balloon survives for, say, 3 months inside a human body, does pretty well in surviving repeated inflations and deflations. So take this catheter, paint it with automotive flexible paints and fabric paints, so it resembles somewhat, when inflated, a male real frog's vocal sac. Now I can insert that through the cavity of the body of the faux frog. Next step, attach feet, clean up all the cast, paint it with layers of acrylic and then oil, spray it so that it looks like it's in water and glistens a little bit, and for human perception more than frog perception, make those eyes glisten gold and black.
They're incredibly realistic.
Ooh, I need to make a Mach 2 and 3 with Joey in which... I want them to inflate alternately, body and vocal sac. I'd also like a future faux frog to interact with external stimuli like a female approaching that male. I think that would be ideal because then you can control and automate a male that resembles not only a static male or a calling male, but a male that might respond as it does naturally or remotely in a controlled fashion by us in a lab situation.
I'm wondering if you made a video that's on YouTube of the mating call of the tundra frog. You gave us great rendition earlier, but I'm wondering if we should just listen to a few seconds of this video that you made.
And everyone's mimicry of the tundra frog is different.
So we just heard the sound of the tundra frog, and you were kind of explaining the different sounds that the male makes. And if you see in the video, you see that the female is slowly approaching, almost with each croak.
Yeah, what you've witnessed is a male calling, but that's really a robotic male calling with a computer-synthesized call. So it's considered somewhat of an average attractive male call. So it's not technically a true or actual male frog call. So you've got the synthetic visual, the synthetic but somewhat realistic and certainly convincing acoustic within a sound-resistant or sound-insulated chamber that's used by Ryan Taylor and others in Gamboa, Panama, in the canal zone of Panama, where we collaborate.
And this research has moved on from the laboratory, as you said, to into the jungles of Panama, correct?
Well, so it started with Ryan Taylor's work in temperate regions with the Squirrella, the squirrel frog. There are precedents in robo-frogs. Peter Nerens and his lab has produced really beautiful kinetic dendrobatted dart poison frogs for daytime male-male interactions, and that's really beautiful work. What we've done here is we've looked at multimodal signaling at dusk or at night in frogs that are considered to be primarily, if not exclusively, courting by sound to see if multimodal signaling can play a role, if vision can play a role under such conditions. So yeah, we've taken it to the tropics, to Central America, to Panama, and the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute is based on Barrow, Colorado Island and in Gamboa on the mainland in the canal zone.
So why is it important to study the habits of this one frog? And as you talked about, you know, you found that the female is wooed by these different signals. It's not just
right.
The sounds that it makes, but everything else surrounding it.
So there are many reasons, many ways to answer that question. And while we are interested in evolution, ecology, and behavior, and not just in this very common mottled brown tungra frog of Panama, but across organisms, we wanted to test whether we can generalize, if we can find patterns in nature with respect to multisensory or multimodal signaling, how to communicate effectively. And the ecology component comes into play when you've got different environments, when you've got, say, a single individual calling in a relative vacuum versus a mass, a crowd, a cacophony of frogs attempting to call and communicate, where you might have relevance ecologically, behaviorally, with humans, you could argue. So, for example, the cocktail effect. There might be 20 people in this room talking and talking and talking. And if one across the room happens to say Barrett or Robo-Frog, strangely, I can orient toward and distinguish that out of the cacophony. So this cocktail effect is a fascinating perceptual anomaly that may not be an anomaly. And so to understand it better under somewhat natural or naturalistic conditions in this frog could be pretty telling. Then we can look at evolution. If what we can find to be true in one amphibian is true under certain conditions across a number of amphibians and beyond amphibia to other tetrapods, to other vertebrates, maybe we can look at patterns in nature and look at causes of certain evolutionary trajectories.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about how a UW-La Crosse assistant professor of biology, Barrett Klein, helped design a robotic frog to study mating habits. Do you think that this research, Barrett, could carry over into other frog species? And is it yet?
Would you believe that scientists are banging down my door to have robo-frogs made?
Well, I would. I mean, I'm seeing them in front of you right now, and I kind of wish that I was doing this research.
Well, you're welcome to.
Thank you.
There are a few scientists who have been interested in including robotics, and this is actually becoming a really influential area because if you're going to answer questions, but you're limited with respect to how you can manipulate a situation or an organism under natural or naturalistic conditions, can you relieve yourself of that limitation? One way to ask otherwise impossible, intractable questions with frogs or any animal, including humans, would be to make fake ones that are convincing enough in one or more modalities to elicit behaviors in other organisms of the same species. So with the frogs, if you're stuck asking certain questions, say, for example, you see a calling male, and you see a frog approach that male, and it doesn't have to be the tungra frog, it could be any sexual frog species, you might ask the question, was it the pitch of the call? Was it the intensity of the call? How loud is it? You know, or is it how it situated itself? Is it the physical behavior of displacing the water by the vocal sac? What is it about that call? Well, you can conduct observational experiments in the field and take notes fastidiously and attempt to render conclusions or come to conclusions with respect to the notes you've taken. But manipulation is the hallmark of experimental biology. And so if you can manipulate a situation in a controlled fashion, then you can better make a claim as to what factors are eliciting behaviors, say in that female. So robots, if appropriately, wisely created and presented, can relieve you of certain constraints in experimental biology.
Do you see any research happening in this area with frogs and possibly creating prototypes for species up here?
Mark B. in Minneapolis, Minnesota, has a rip-roaring lab with frogs. And there's a lab in UW-Milwaukee that works beautifully with frogs. And I think both of them would like to introduce, and actually are in the process of introducing, some false frogs in order to test such questions.
Researchers across the country, around the world, have used other species. I read about robotic squirrels.
Yes.
Some robotic cockroaches, which may be
indeed
one of the favorites of yours. But are you familiar with some of the other studies and maybe the differences that those studies have made in using robotic animals?
When you create a sculpture or when you create a molded, casted work for an exhibit, with each problem, with each sample presents a new challenge. And so with these frogs, we had a whole set of potentially unique challenges. And when you enter a mammal or bird realm, you're going to face additional challenges. So the sage grouse cyborg or robot that has been produced by Gail Patricelli, and the cockroach work and the squirrel work and others, there's lizard work as well, face a number of hurdles that will be different but intriguing. How real do you have to render your robot? And that will vary. That will vary not only with respect to species and their visual or other modality constraints, but also the context within which they do make their calls or when they communicate, whether it be verbally, vocally, or whether it be with gesticulations, in the case largely of the sage grouse. So she has a train track with a bird that shuttles down that train track toward a bird, and with very simple motions can elicit male responses. And that's marvelous. I mean, that's really telling and marvelous. It goes beyond, say, static examples and models, and it goes beyond kinetics. Recently, there's a lab that's produced cyborg insects, so very large beetles that, due to some electronics that are feeding off of muscle contraction in the wings, you can actually direct flight in these beetles. So it's going in very bizarre and intriguing new directions.
And something like using robotic animals or insects or frogs in research, that's not ever going to be something that completely replaces natural observations out in the wild, correct?
No, we always need to go back to the organism. A robot is never a surrogate. A model is never a surrogate. All it is a tool that a scientist can use to try to standardize and try to examine a naturally occurring, biologically relevant behavior in order to better understand the behavior of that organism, ideally in the wild, in a natural state. So any bit of robotics should take the good scientist back to the field, back to observing the organisms in nature in order to better understand and ground that those observations in the lab in the field.
Are creating these prototypes, is it costly? Is it something that it's so new that maybe more researchers aren't doing yet, or are there financial limitations to that?
It can be very inexpensive or, for many, prohibitively expensive, depending on what you'd like the outcome to be. Certain studies that I was mentioning earlier that create, that fabricate wax or clay models, oh, that could be $20 or so to produce a frog. It could be even less. To create something like this that depends on a de novo, a unique and new controlling unit that controls the simultaneous computer robot integration, namely Joey Stein's work at MOE Inc., that is more expensive. Now, once you create the first, you can make it a lot less expensive. What I'd like to do with these frogs, rather than depend on catheter balloons or pneumatics, displacement of objects with air, what I'd like to do is a mechanical pushing, maybe of rubber or urethane, a squishy ball, so that you've got a realistic frog that just has a mechanical unit below it that will just displace a gel. That could be really inexpensive, potentially.
Do you want to keep working with robotic frogs, or would you like to venture off into other species or insects? Or
I would love to continue my wonderful collaborations with Ryan Taylor, Michael Ryan, Joey Stein in the marvelous world of herpetology, especially with amphibians. I'm an entomologist at heart, so I'll always return to especially the social hymenoptera, bees, wasps, ants. But yes, I would love to continue long-term prospects, not just with the Tungara frog, but with other frogs. And we have ideas in the works of working with some temperate frogs to answer questions that delve into evolution of signaling, as well as ecological constraints and issues, and behavior, because I'm a behaviorist.
Do you think right now is a very important time to be studying frogs?
Any work that involves frogs to make people aware of and appreciate this diverse group of amphibians is important in terms of inspiring people to beware and protect, to conserve, to preserve the amphibians that are alive today, because there are massive extinctions, especially at higher elevations, of frogs and other amphibians around the planet due to chytrid fungus and complications. So yes, I think any work that deals with nature can compel people toward biophilia, and any work specifically with frogs can excite people, inspire people to embrace frogs and be aware of the threats that are facing frogs.
Barrett Klein is an assistant professor of biology at UW-La Crosse. He, for the last few years, has worked on a research project helping to design a robotic frog that studies mating habits. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Our production team includes Maureen McCollum, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find extended interviews, pictures, and related web links. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also find Newsmakers on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.